Session number 14129, Sydney East, Reel 4.
They were the bombers going in, obviously to some target. I suppose this must have been 1 o'clock in the morning, somewhere around that period of time. And we were all out, the six of us were out on the wings. And one of the chaps said, I can't swim. I said, well, if you hang on to the wings, they may stay afloat. Dickie said, I'm going to swim for it. I said, well, up to you. Every man for himself, isn't it? So he said, yes. He said, I'm off. That was Lieutenant Dickie Hansen. And I must recap for a second here. The night before, when we were sitting under the olive trees, after we'd been briefed, I remember Dickie saying to me, he was a spiritualist, by the way, he said, you know, I've got a feeling I'm going to get drowned. I said, come off it, don't be so bloody cheerful. He said, well, it's just a feeling I have. I said, oh. Well, that's nice thought as we're going out for a long trip over the sea. He said, well, I just have this peculiar feeling. Now, that is absolutely true, and I think about that often when I think of the landing in the sea. And he said, well, I'm going off. I said, okay, I can't stop you. So off he went. He was a reasonably good swimmer. We'd taken everything off by then, our boots, because we used to fly with our heavy boots and everything on. Took all our gear off, except we just kept a shirt on. And I kept my berry, I think. I did. And the sergeant major, the troops did the same. And she was still creaking and groaning, and I thought any minute now the whole bloody lot's going to go down. That was the feeling I got. Whether it ever did or not, I'll never know. But Dickie went, and after about a quarter of an hour, this fellow kept moaning he couldn't swim. I said, well, just stay on the wing. And I thought, well, I think I'll go. I'll have a swim. So I said to them, I said, well, look, I don't know about you, chap, but you stay on this. It should be all right. The fewer of us on it, the better. I'm going to swim for it now. So I started off in what I thought was the right direction. I could see a star, which I sort of, I'll try and swim towards it. And the sea was beginning to ease off a bit. Wasn't too bad. It was quite warm being the Mediterranean. Very warm. So that was nice. So I started swimming. And I swam for half an hour, towards an hour. I got very tired. So I just lay back. You can float, you see. You lay back and rested. Then carried on again. And by which time, I was alone in the sea. Is a very peculiar feeling. I couldn't hear anything else. I could hear the chop of the sea, but nothing else. And as the time went on, I thought, well, I must be getting the right way. And I've still got that star in my sights. And as I came after another half hour swimming, I could see what I thought was a fire, way high up in the distance. I thought, I'm sure that's the fire I saw. And that must be land. Started to swim again, but mind you, I must admit I was very, very tired, but I suddenly started to swim, and then I heard the engines of a boat very close to me. I thought, oh, I'll give a shout. So I shouted. Well, nobody took any notice. And this bloody thing went past me. It was a huge battleship. And I thought, well, battleship, I must be a bloody long way out here. However, I'll start, keep going swimming. And I kept on swimming. And another half hour, and I started to get very cold. So I used to swim frantically to get my blood circulating. I thought that was the only thing to do. And then suddenly, I don't know what it was, there was a huge salvo of explosions. It seemed to be right on top of me. I thought, God, they're not firing at me, surely. That was my first reaction. Then I realised, oh no, that's something bigger. And right going over me were the shells and rockets onto the beach, and I could see them where they were landing. Oh, about possibly half a mile ahead. The rockets from the battleships and the salvos. I could see see them splattering the beaches. Whew, I think I can make it now. So I rested. And as I rested, suddenly, out of all the mist, I was surrounded by boats going in, LCTs. Land support craft were going in, full of troops, onto the beach. I thought, oh, dear me, I made it, you know. Lovely. And I shouted to one of them, oi, that under the water, you see. The bloke said, sorry, mate, we're going in. I thought, you bastards. I'd come all that way and I couldn't get a lift. So they went on. I saw them all go ashore from this height, water height.
Up to your chin.
Up to my chin in water. I could see all the troops moving in. There was a machine gun corner in the right-hand side. I didn't see anybody falter. I can remember I didn't. And I saw the ball moving up the beach. And then I thought, well, now they've all gone. I'll carry on. Because there was nothing I could do anyway. I started swimming towards the beach. And another LCT pulled alongside me, an empty one this time. And a naval chap said, on the lift. Naval officer he was. And I looked up at him and said, yes, please. He grabbed hold of me, pulled me up onto the side. And I dropped out on the deck. Whoa, knackered. I was only probably 200 yards from the beach then. And he said, here, try this. Will you look about all in? I said, all in? I'm knackered. He said, try this. And he poured, I thought it was a water bottle. Well, it was a water bottle, but I thought it was water. But I think it was rum. In fact, I know it was rum. He poured this down my throat. And he said, we're just going to drop a bit of mortar over there. There's a bit of opposition. Then he said, we'll take you to the hospital ship. I said, oh, man, I just lay on the deck. I was so tired. I'd been swimming three and a half hours. A bit tired. And I lay on the deck of this ship. Went right off to sleep. Fast asleep. It was the rum, I think, helped me, mind you. The next thing I knew, I was alongside a hospital ship. The Princess Beatrix. And the chappy said, well, I think you better, we'll help you aboard now. I said, no, I'll be all right, I think. And I'd been lying out on the sun deck. And I went to move, I couldn't move my arms. I thought, oh my God, what's that? So they helped me up. I said, I can't move my arms. And they got to get up that companionway up the side of this vessel. He said, well, just try and, oh God, it was so painful. He said, well, you better get aboard. So I got onto the companionway, struggled up this side of it, in agony with my arms, got to the top, and I'd still got my shirt and my berry. Still got them on, strange as it may seem. And the fellow, there was a major at the top of the gangway, and he said, I say, I thought you chaps were airborne, not seaborne. If I hadn't been in such pain, I think I would have hit him on the spot for such a ridiculous remark. Now, that man was Major Churchill, the War Correspondent. I never forget that. Never, ever. Of all the remarks to make, I thought that was very out of order. I was taken below by the nurses anyway. And I said, I don't know, I can't move my arms properly. She said, I'm not surprised. I said, why? How long have you been in the water? I said, about 3 hours or so. She said, your all the salts got into your... You've been swimming in that shirt and you've rubbed the salt in. She said, we're going to have to peel that off. And then you've let the sun dry on it. I said, I don't know what I've been doing. See, they said, well, this is going to hurt. And they put a whole lot of oil on it. Then ripped it off. Oh, God, it hurt. All from here. And I was bandaged up like this. And that was my war in Sicily. I was bandaged up. And I managed to get back to my unit, of course, eventually.
Back in Africa. How can you explain why you had been dropped into the sea?
Well, it wasn't for me to explain that. It was for my tow pilot.
Have you any idea?
Yes. Afterwards, we did learn that there were 600 drowned, by the way, on that exercise. 600, about. But we lost quite a few hundred glider pilots as well. No, 52 glider pilots, and the others were troops, sorry. But 52 out of about 200 is quite a lot anyway. We learned afterwards on the debriefing that the American pilots were airline pilots 3 weeks ago and were drafted straight, or 3 or 4 weeks ago, and drafted straight into the American Army Air Corps to become tug pilots or passenger, troop-carrying pilots. And the aircraft they had were just civil airliners, civilian airliners without any armoury on them whatsoever. No self-sealing tanks, no armoured seats, nothing. So they did have no protection against any flak. I think probably that was one of the reasons why they didn't get any closer to the flak. And the, mind you, not that we had any protection from it. And the other reason was that the American navigators, I think they used to have one navigator per, well, I don't know, maybe for about six aircraft. They didn't carry a navigator in each aircraft. So that unless the pilot was an extremely good navigator, which most of them weren't, it was a navigation error as well.
You told me earlier off the tape that you and some of your comrade survivors wanted a bit of revenge.
We did, and the order was out that any glider pilots were to be arrested. However, it didn't take place because it was General Hackett that had that order. At that time, he was a brigadier, and he'd had that order, but he said he never had to carry it out because he realised what deep-thinking blokes the glider pilots were. I think that's his story, but as he is our patron, I must admit.
Were you personally looking for revenge afterwards?
I was for a while, I must admit, because Dickie had been drowned. I don't know what happened to the other four blokes, and I wasn't feeling very 100%. But then, thinking about it, when I'd heard some of these Americans saying it, I realised probably it was the fault of the whole operation in general. It was too quickly done. Very bad planning from the staff point of view.
Did you actually actively seek revenge?
No, no. Nobody did.
How long did you personally take to recover from your experience?
Well, I suppose we went to a holiday, so-called a holiday camp. These soon healed up, I must admit. Yeah, they soon healed up. And then we had a holiday at Tunis Bay, Hammamet. At Hammamet at that time, there was one house. That was all. I believe now it's a complete holiday resort. But then, there was just this big house. I believe King Edward had been there. Edward VIII. It was a beautiful, beautiful big house. Had a swimming pool and everything. And right on the beach, too.
Did you have any permanent after effects?
No, I don't think so. We didn't have any counselling like they do today, if that's what you mean. Nobody had any counselling in those days.
Did you need it?
I don't think so. No, I don't think so.
So what happened after you'd recovered?
I think that, getting back to counselling for a moment, if I may, I think one of the reasons why in the wartime you didn't have any counselling was because the war was 24 hours a day, and nobody had any time for that. And that's my own summing up of it.
Did you go back to the regiment after you'd recovered?
Oh, yes, yes. Ah, the survivors were all there. All came back to Hammamet, to this beautiful place, this house, which I don't know, George had got hold of it somehow, George Chatterton. And we had a whale of a time there for a couple of weeks. Lovely time. The wine was flowing, the whiskey was flowing, the beer was flowing, the tobacco was being smoked. It was really a very lovely time.
This was still a second squadron glider pilot?
Yes, two squadron, yes. We had a lovely time there. I think that helped us recover a lot.
And there was a... Had it put you off going on to any operations again?
No, don't think so.
So did you start to prepare for a new operation?
No, but then, after this lovely holiday we had, nobody knew what to do. There weren't any more gliders. At that time, I would add this, that I didn't mention it at the beginning. There were some gliders flown out from England, Horsa gliders, from England to North Africa, which is a long, long tow. And I think the gentleman to tell you all about that is one of the gentlemen that was on it, and that was Harry Antonopoulos. He's in that list. I'll tell you about him. Now, he was came down twice in the Mediterranean. In the Bay of Biscay. He was shot down by condors on one occasion.
On the flight out?
Yes, which was the German aircraft.
So where did you go? Where did you go to start to prepare for new operations?
Well, we were still in North Africa. After that, there were no gliders. A lot more glider pilots had come out then, but there were no gliders. And it was decided, it was then when, August, September, that August it was, that's right. There might be an operation in Italy, but weren't they glad us? So those of us who, particularly my flight that were in it, 2 Squadron, suddenly we were told, OK, we're going to go to Italy. But this time we're doing sea landings. As we haven't got igladas, we've got to do seaborne landing. So we thought, well, if it's anything like the fracas and the last one, it'll be a complete nonsense. However, it wasn't too bad. We went on the, name escapes me now, a ship into Taranto Harbour on the 11th of September. We were following the HMS Abdiel. She was another Navy ship. And she was taking a paratroop battalion in, and she hit a mine. Most of them were killed, unfortunately.
Did you see it?
No, I didn't see it. I saw the bodies out floating in the water afterwards. We had to bury a lot of them. And then we went ashore in assault boats, but there was nothing to assault because there was nobody there. They'd, only the Italians, and they were welcoming us. They weren't sort of firing at us at all. They were only too glad it was all over, I think. This was in Taranto. And we had a job then of guarding the fleet. Can you imagine it? The whole of the Italian fleet. About 26 glider pilots, I thought was rather good. Well, actually, it was on a bridge to the harbour. There's a bridge across. And we were sort of put on that bridge to guard the bridge. Not that it would have been any use at all, because it was a swing bridge. If the Navy really wanted to do anything, they'd have just blown up the bridge apart and gone straight through. However, the Italian Navy were completely hors de combat then. They were finished. After that, we moved up towards a place called Puntignano. We marched through Taranto, and then we went to Puntignano. We were in a school there. We didn't seem to do really much at all.
Did you do any more operations in Italy?
No, we were just sort of guarding prisoners, or wounded, sorry, just background in case anything, I don't know, in case the Italians rose up, I don't know, really. Nobody seemed to know what we were doing there.
So how long did you stay in Italy?
Until the Christmas.
Christmas 43?
43.
Then did you transfer back to Britain?
And then we went back to North Africa, and from North Africa we got back to North Africa. Ah, yes. When we left for Italy, we went to what they call a transportation camp called Texas Camp for 3 or 4 days, which was a transit camp. And we were all stopped a day's pay here for barrack damages. We can't think why. And it, camp improvements. When we came back to exactly the same camp. And it was exactly the same, nothing had been done at all. So our wonderful RSM, who I've told you about, Mick Briody, called a mess meeting. And he said, well, I don't know about you lot, but we all lost a day's pay here. And they're wanting another one. Now, can you see any improvements? We said, no, we'd forgotten that day's pay. We can't see any improvement. We'd like our day's pay back. Right. Well, see what I can do. And the day's pay then was a lot of money, because we were getting flying pay, core pay, and all sorts of things. So he went to see the colonel commandant of the camp. We got our money back. Now, what that colonel commandant was doing, nobody knows. But I think there was some sort of fiddle going on. But not with RSM Briody. He stopped it as far as we were concerned.
But you're there. You were in transit to Britain.
Yes. Then we went on a train to get across to Oran to catch a boat back. And the train had an accident on the way. We ran into another train. Fortunately, we didn't get hurt, but one or two did. And so that delayed us a bit, with the result that we missed the boat we were supposed to go on Christmas Day. We were boarding the boat. The train accident delayed us, you see. That was in the middle of the desert somewhere. We weren't happy about it either, because we travelled in those days. We didn't travel in railway coaches. We travelled in freight coaches, which had on them 8 chevaux, 40 hommes. In other words, 8 horses or 40 men. And we used to travel in these coaches, in these trucks, I mean. About 20 of us, plenty of room. But there was straw in them, and that was it. And we would travel for 2 or 3 days in those.
So you went on a troop ship back to Britain,
and then we
over
back
the
to...
New Year period?
Yes, that's right.
Where did you go to in Britain?
Liverpool. My hometown.
Where was your camp in Britain?
Tilshead. So we went on trains down there, but I went home first. We landed there, and I thought, well, I'll pop home for a few hours, which I did.
Was this for training for D-Day?
That's right. Then we came back.
So were the second squadron?
We were 2 squadron then, but when we came back, that was all split up. That squadrons had been given names, letters, and although we were given the letter of F squadron, most of F was split up and spread around. I was put into D squadron. And after going on a embarkation leave, I had to report back to Slape in Shropshire, where we started ferrying Horsa gliders from the makers in Christchurch. Gliders were made mostly by furniture makers, you see. They weren't made by aircraft people. And we ferried them back to formulate D squadron of a lot of pilots who'd been training whilst we'd been abroad. And
what type of gliders was D squadron equipped with?
Horses then. And then we were also training 196 squadron of Stirlings. The Stirlings were then towing the gliders, Stirling bombers, which was a good aircraft for towing. And that was the build-up. We did lots of mass landings and all sorts of things then, the build-up for D-Day. Now, D-Day, the original first six were specially trained. Jim Walwick, who'd been with me all the time, by the way, learnt to fly it. We learnt joined together. He was the first glider on the bridge at Pegasus Bridge, Jim Walwick. Now then, if you wanted him, he's only coming over for 13 days. But he lives in British Columbia now. That's a good trip for you.
Yes, I've heard about him.
Jim, he's an old chum of mine.
Can you take me through your own D-Day memories of what happened to you, please?
Not a lot. D-Day, I wasn't on the night lifts at all. You know, the D-minus lifts, I wasn't on those. There were only 6 gliders on those. I was on the evening lift of D-Day.
The evening of the 6th of June?
Yeah. And that was really most uneventful. I took in a jeep and a trailer of ammunition and 2 troops.